vacation in French Lick, Indiana, in a big hotel. I suffered my first heart attack. Very much to surprise, this big resort hotel had no access to a physician. And the nearest one was about 15 miles in a small community. So we got in a car, and Kay was driving, and she was giving me another heart attack. So by the time we reached the interstate, I got behind the wheel, drove myself to the Carbondale Clinic, where they put me into intensive care. Eventually I was moved to the Barnes Hospital in St. Louis for an angioplasty. Well, you look yourself on a monitor, and they couldn't get through, so they put me under, and I wake up 2 days later with a heart bypass, a double bypass. Ever since, I'm on probation. I had a fainting spell connected with my poor blood circulation 10 years later. While driving home from St. Louis, I felt faint. I was in presence of a friend of mine who is a physician, and she gave me first aid. She's a physician from my hometown of Ostrava, needless to say, where he is a visiting professor, and she's learning English to be able to practice medicine. That ended up with a catheterization where a stent was put into my heart. Problem with my heart was in 1999, I was on a world cruise and fell down fainting in Durban, South Africa. I went back on a cruise ship, and 2 days later I experienced a similar fainting spell. The physician on board was an obstetrician. He wanted me off the cruise ship in a hurry. So when we anchored at East London, South Africa, they transferred me to the local hospital. But they did not have a cardiologist, so subsequently they flew me to Cape Town, South Africa, in a private hospital with an excellent cardiologist. They examined me, found out that the stent in my heart that was placed at the Barnes Hospital in St. Louis was either growing together, collapsing, or not wide enough to enable proper blood circulation. So they blew up the stent. And 2 days later, I was on a plane home. I mean, this original stent that was placed, it was as an outpatient, although I did stay overnight. And enlarging it, blowing it up, was a procedure that our cardiologist here keep shaking the head. I mean, how was it done? they gave me x-ray picture that shows where the location was, and they did not explain to me exactly the technique that would blow up a wire mesh screen that has been put into my heart. Right now, I still have problems with blood circulation. I'm unable to walk for any lengths. Lactic acid keeps accumulating and my muscle tighten up. And when I get home next week, they will try to locate where the blockage is. I mean, ultrasound located the blockage, but not precisely enough. Which keeps me sort of on the edge, because I'm scheduled to travel to China and Tibet starting in October. And if physician so far has not objected to my next trial, but we shall see what the test all about. One thing that concerns me about the projected trip is that Lhasa, the capital city of Tibet, is very high in the mountains, and people suffer altitude sickness without having a questionable heart. And but again, physician said no, did not object to my projected trip.
Maybe you could get one of the little oxygen cylinders and carry that along with you.
Well, this has been suggested, and doing a lot of traveling with a commercial outfit out of Boston called Grand Circle Travel, and they are also aware of my physical condition, and they're looking very, very well after the guests or the travelers.
We didn't. I know you've been on a number of world cruises. I know you've traveled a tremendous amount. Is there any place left on the face of the earth that you haven't been that you want to go?
Well, interestingly enough, the reason why I go to China and Tibet is because I have not been in Tibet. I've been in China several times. But Tibet is one of those places I have not seen. Now, sure, there are a lot of places in the Middle East, Iran, Iraq, Lebanon. It's not recommended by our State Department at this time.
Right.
I've been in several places in Africa, Egypt many times, South Africa, Kenya, Morocco, and so on. But Tibet is sort of intriguing to me. So let's hope it's possible. Travel for the last 10 years since I retired, I mean personal travel, became a major occupation. Some years we spend as many as 5 months out of the year away from home.
I think we've just about covered every question that we have here. Anything else that you can think of you want to add to this?
Not right now.
Well, all right.
Give me a few minutes.
Right. Okay, we're going to go have some food. There's one thing, though, that I think that you ought to put together to append to this, and that'd be a list of your publications and patents.
Have it here.
Oh, you already have it. Oh, well, great. That's great. So we'll.
He brought some Georgian cognac and some St. Louis. I'll go and Dejurnia. Did you ever meet a Dejurnia? The woman sits on each floor and monitors who goes to what room.
Yeah, we had that.
And she gives you the key.
Right, we had that.
And I go past it and she says, "Where are you going?" Did not know the role of a Dejurnia, but I learned quickly. Said, "I'm going to meet a friend." "Oh, no, you're not." "So, yes, I will." So she goes with me, and we knock on the door. The open. A friend from the plane, he said, the mother woman, and I made a friend. And Dejurnia says, "The door will stay open, otherwise you cannot stay here. The door will stay open to the hallway. Never mind." And after a few drinks, the friend says, "I would like you to see my wife and my newborn baby." Except he lives in a suburb. So he calls his friend, because his license has been suspended because of a drinking violation. The friend, the chauffeur, comes in and drives us into the suburb where he lives. One of those housing developments, faceless housing developments. The steps are broken. Light is hanging from the by a cord, an old light fixture, dingy. Sure enough, we get into his flat. There is a baby there and a wife that's studying. And George and Cognac is very good. And several rounds have been consumed. And suddenly the conversation switches to politics. That stupid Russian is accusing our Georgian, fellow Georgian, Stalin. I mean, this is incredible. I mean, how can Khrushchev be so offensive to a local hero? Stalin was a Georgian.
Yeah.
Before. And what do I think about it? I said, Stalin, who? Never heard of any.
You're smart. You're very smart.
I said, I have to go back to the hotel. I mean, I wouldn't enter that conversation.
No.
Absolutely. No. So this didn't work. The following day, my friend from a plane meets me in the lobby of the hotel. Originally, she planned to go to the Black Sea, to a place, Suchomi. I said, I'm going to Sochi on vacation, which is also a resort on the Black Sea. As a guest of the Georgian Academy, they are sending me to Sochi. She said, I'm changing my mind. I'm not going to Sochi. I'll go with you to Sochi. A flight originated in Tbilisi at 6 o'clock in the morning. She said, I don't know how I'm going to get to the airport. Never mind, I asked my people who will pick me up. They usually come, the headman, an assistant, and a chauffeur, mind you, to pick you up and drive you to the airport. At 5 o'clock in the morning, we board the plane and fly to Sochi. We arrive around 7 o'clock in the morning. Nobody's waiting for me. I have no idea what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to be a guest or a captain. I don't know what or when anybody's going to meet. Well, people at the counter said, well, everything's closed right now. Why don't you take a taxi and drive to the hotel where all the foreigners stay? We arrive at the hotel, and I ask her, today, I'm Professor Wolle from the United States. Do you have any message? Oh, Professor Wolle, so glad that you have a good trip. But our office is closed. The secretary of the meeting will be here at 10 o'clock. And I said, well, what meeting? Well, the Pugwash conference was meeting in Sochi. You ever heard of the Pugwash conference?
I've heard the term.
Cyrus Eaton, the Canadian millionaire who was promoting peace.
Yeah.
That international conference is going to be held in the hotel. The hotel is completely taken over by the member of the attendees. The secretary knows I'm a professor from America. Obviously, I'm a member of the conference. Well, it comes 10 o'clock and he goes through the list. Obviously, he doesn't find my name. Drop dead, essentially, tell me. Hotel completely filled by conference. So I'm turning to her now. What am I going to do? And I said, never mind. She goes to the manager's office. She spends half an hour there and come out laughing. We found a hotel that will accept you. You don't check in, the hotel will accept you. They ordered a taxi and drive me to the hotel. She's staying there too. She's staying has a room, four or five rooms down the hall. And we agreed we're going to walk on the boardwalk, which resembles the boardwalk. Anyway, and I changed into Bermuda shorts. And we are walking, and people look at me. So it made me feel very uncomfortable, because nobody wears shorts.
Yes.
Women in a bikini hanging over with the fat, that's all right, you know. But slacks, I didn't have. I said, well, I would like to go back to the room and then change into slacks. I don't feel so obvious or out of place. Now, we walked back, and I asked for my key to the room. The Dujourneau says, oh, we are very sorry, we gave you the wrong room. But never mind, we already transported your belongings. It was a room identical with the previous one. You know, everything is in, it's so uniform. And my luggage is there, my toothbrush, everything, identical as it was when I left. The only answers that we could come in, there was no mistake. They wanted to know who I am, and they did not want to be surprised going through my belongings. So they just moved me, but being so professional in searching luggage, that they put everything in the identical places and positions that I would. Had I not known it's a different room, I never would recognize that it was gone through.
Well, now the woman, this woman, was she? She was somebody assigned to.
Well,
to.
I had that feeling when I came back. I was debriefed. I told them about this episode, and when we came back after a period of time, he said, "You were right. We have found her." In the archive. She was an interest guide.
Okay.
That's what she said. Mm-hmm. And the way she explained to me, an interest guide escorting German tourists. And the way she explained it to me was that she was supposedly on the same plane, but she had no business waiting in the waiting room assigned to foreigners, because she was not escorting anybody. And she said, she looked around the waiting room, and I was the most likely person that would speak German. And why? Because at that time I was wearing a Tyrolean hat, one of those Austrian hat. I didn't have a badge sticking out. But a very typical Austrian one.
Right.
And she said, I'm more likely to speak German than anybody else. Maybe. I told that CIA officer, and he confirmed that she is in her records.
Okay.
It on.
Okay, it's on.
Okay. I have a similar story to tell you. Again, I was flying alone from Moscow in Uzbekistan, to Tashkent. It's a long flight. I arrive alone. Nobody waits for me at the airport. I have no idea where to go, who to contact. So I take my passport, go to a police station, militia police station, say, Amerikansky Professor Los Academia now. I'm an American professor, guest of the Soviet Academy or something. Nobody is waiting for me. Can you help me? The policeman almost faints. I'm there asking for help. And he sits me down in a police station, brings tea, making frantic phone calls, because I have no visa for Tashkent. My visa is only for Moscow. So what the hell is he going to do? I came there for help. So By that time, I knew Russian enough that I could overhear the conversation and knew the gist of what was being said. They were very polite and never interrogated me. Eventually, just to get rid of me, they called a taxi cab and said, well, maybe in a hotel where all foreigners stay, we'll know about you. Take me to a hotel, nobody knows about me either. The girl at the service desk, remember, they have a service desk. She said, my husband works at the academy, but we have no idea what you're doing here. And why don't you go eat a dinner, come back and see what I can, how I can help you. Came back from dinner, and she said, I couldn't find anybody. It's closed. But don't worry. I said, what? Where am I going to stay? The hotel is full, I was told. Don't worry. Sit down. So in about 20 minutes, the bellboy comes, picks up my luggage, and takes me to the room. And the Russian was evacuated. He was kicked out of his room to make room for me.
Okay.
But for 2 days, nobody knows anything about me being there to lecture or do some interview. After 2 days, a little guy perspiring comes and says, oh, we received a teletype about your coming, but everybody's sick with a grip. What has happened? The cotton season started, and the entire neighborhood or organization were trucked out to the cotton field. Long staple Uzbekistani cotton. So everybody being sick meant really everybody's in a field picking cotton. And what is so remarkable about this is that I was never interrogated. Never. Nobody would raise a muscle in the face to show anger, surprise, or being in doubt of what I'm doing. And when I told this to my conduct, who was debriefing me, he was more interested in the amount of cotton that's being because they have machine. Some cotton is left behind. You have the sharecropper who go.
Yeah, gleaners.
There they do everything by hand and leave nothing on the planet.
Yeah.
And there are mountains where piled up under some kind of canvas for sitting in the air. That was of interest.
I've just found it totally fascinating. Our just little 2 weeks we were there. We went in 87 and went back in 88.
Yeah.
And we were in the big cities, Moscow, St. Petersburg, etc. the first year, but the second year we went back, we just went on our own, and we went to little, we felt we got tours that were going to little tiny towns. And that was fascinating because the people were just
the atmosphere was much more relaxed outside of Moscow. People were more themselves, and I was glad to get out of the city. I know we were one place, and foreigners eat in a separate place.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a wedding next a room. There was a glass door, and I was sort of looking in, and somebody comes out, start talking to me, and tried to offer me drinks and things like that. And I, at that time, I was carrying a Polaroid camera. I go, I take a picture of the bride and groom, and give it to them. Everybody else start converging, start looking, and they come, my picture. And I had a limited number of cassettes that I brought with me.
Yeah, well, these make great stories. I want to move to let's see, now that was 69, and in 72, according to the record I had, you were in several East European countries. Now, what were those? Well, and I guess you were doing the same type of thing there.
When I came back, I wrote a report. In 71, I started my tour, my history.
Oh, yeah, a history chemistry tour.
And 72 was an even number year. I thought I'd do the same kind of study in the East European countries and compare it to Russia and compare it to American education. So I got another assignment from the Academy of Sciences. The report that I submitted, which was published, apparently created enough interest that they hired me again to do the identical study in the other East European, so-called East European countries. Went to Yugoslavia, Bulgaria, Romania, Hungary, and Poland. I also put down that I would like to go to Czechoslovakia. I was not accepted. I mean, that's an interesting thing, because you need an invitation to go. And the Czechoslovakia Academy Center did not invite me. Whether they or whoever looks after security had something to do, I will never know. But anyway, I was not accepted.
But your mission was the same, and you wrote the same kind of report.
Same kind of a report.
Now, did you find
education?
Did you find how did they compare? Were they
well? At that time, they were looking up to the Russian model, the East Europe, the German East European higher, the German type East, the Eastern type Central European educational system. Was replaced by the Russian system.
Okay.
Because we in America, mm-hmm. we inherited a German system as well, whether we understand or realize it in the university education. My throat is running dry a little bit.
Let me flip this.
We were talking about the East European visit. The mission was the same, studying the higher education process, the equivalence to American, and very interesting development. This visit came about because the Academy arranged invitation to each country for a period that I specified. A small country received 1 week, the bigger one like Poland received 3 weeks of my presence. And I went to each major university and technical university to visit, to interview, to make a comparison. It became extremely important to SIU in a roundabout way. During the period, or during the interviews that I conducted in the university in Olsen, I learned of the desire of the local faculty and students to come to America and to study. I knew enough about the background, which was excellence of ice chemistry. I also knew of their ability to speak English. And I said, you know, SIU is not unique in America. We need teaching assistants, and we are unable to recruit qualified undergraduate students to come to SIU and do graduate work. Well, why don't you apply? We accept any application. The only criteria we have is a competence. And he says, we are not permitted to apply. But I said, I have seen, for example, Polish students. Oh, that's different. If somebody comes and offers a student an assistantship, that fellow can apply for permission to come and accept services. But he cannot apply for the position. Somebody has to go and offer this to him. I came back home and I called a staff meeting. That's my chairman at that time, but I arranged for a faculty meeting. And I said, "You all know that we are not getting qualified graduates in the system. I know of a source that will provide it, provided we can offer it to them." So how can you offer a position of a student that you know have no credentials? And I said, "I'm going to put my reputation on line, because I know of places where the we have or they have qualified individuals who are unable to come because of the inability to apply. But if we offer them, they'll come and they will be first class students. I guarantee." That is completely to the contrary of a graduate school admission office. How you are not permitted to invite anybody without they examining the record. So, being persuasive, as Ned said, I bucked the system. Let's put it on a trial period. If they don't turn out the way I described, that's the end of it. This itself had a history. While I was in Wroclaw at that's the Polish name of Breslau.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, I was in the middle of a story. We're looking at Colombo.
Oh.
I'll bring the milk and sugar in.
While I was in Wroclaw, the vice rector, vice president for International Cardinals turned out to be a very likable fellow in Kenya. He was my host. And we start talking over drinks, maybe too much of drink, about the deficiencies of our educational system and the procedure that we all go through. The Polish, like the Russian, had much too much bureaucracy. We had our own civil servants to deal with. He said, "How can we short-circuit the whole thing?" He says, "I will recommend you student that I know will fill the position successfully. But you have to do your part, you have to invite them." We made an agreement. That agreement brought to SIU a student, a graduate student from Wroclaw, Poland, and one from Belgrade. I tell you about the one from Belgrade a little bit more later on. These students finished their PhD work in record time.
Who was it? Yeah. You
want milk in here? No, we eventually changed the mind of the graduate school. We were able to initiate contact without going through the graduate school at all. It extended into area other than chemistry. They saw the success of the program, the high caliber and quality, and the program rolled over into engineering, it rolled over into geography, into foreign languages, who came and started teaching Russian in our foreign department, foreign language department. And it became a model one. Now, it was the first successful program that integrated East European University into the American educational system. performance. I received a grant from the State Department to foster this international exchange, because our people had to go over. They didn't have some money. We were able to subsidize that trip, so indeed it was two-way proposition. Our people going over there and they coming to Kabul. The State Department at that time said, well, they're interested in my proposal, into my solution, how to bring qualified people from East European country to America. But isn't this going to be a device for them to stay or emigrate to America? No, I said, not to my knowledge. We are not going to help them. We have no intention for them to stay. And furthermore, they're on a payroll, on leave from their respective university, with a paid vacation time in their home country and returning. They have a position waiting for them after they get their American degree. Now, this became well known about in our faculty as well as the students who were coming. Now, the student that from Yugoslavia, her name is Vera Kolb, K-O-L-B, graduated as a second student who graduated in this program, knowing that we have committed ourselves not to encourage a student to stay. She went to Belgrade, resumed her position that was waiting for me. Or about 3 months later, after she left, somebody knocks on my door. I had a windowless office. She opens the door. Vera, what are you doing here? And Vera says, look, shows me her diamond ring. So her major professor, named Karl Myers, went to Belgrade to marry her. She would not marry him while in Kabul. He had to fulfill her obligation to go back. And once you are back, you're not back in our jurisdiction anymore. Well, I had some inkling of a romance going on, because Vera Kolb turned out to be very fiery sort of individual. And she would talk back to her professor. And you could hear them shout at each other across the hallway. We were on the same floor. So she did not behave just like a former student. She was standing her position so far as mechanism of organic reaction. And she never, for a long time, she did not accept American citizenship. Although she qualified because of marriage, that was during a time where too many ugly Americans. And she said, it's safer for me to travel on a Yugoslav passport. Now, other graduates from this program here are well-known professors now in major universities, including Berkeley, including several Canadian institutions. They came back from Poland and drew on the relationship of American PhD. And I just entertained a fellow from Japan. He was not part of the program, but I recruited him in Japan, in Nagasaki, and he didn't have all the qualifications, but I convinced our graduate school to let him remove some of the deficiencies, and he's now full professor of Tokyo University, and he came back from a world lecture tour. And all the Polish, we never had a better quality student in our department. And everybody now refers to me that this was summit of research accomplishment when we had the East European students among them. Excellent student. And all this was done informally. No contract written. I knew Kenja. He came, and many other of his colleagues spent a sabbatical leave teaching in English, freshman chemistry, whatever specialty, like that. Never a better time.
Well, how long did that program run?
Program ran from 1972 or 3. I was in 1972, so the program started operating a year later. And broke down during Solidarity. During the communists, it worked like clockwork. When Solidarity started raising its head in a quest for democracy, there was no discipline left. Before, the students saw the benefits of following the established precedent. After Solidarity, everybody was on its own.
Yeah. In 1974, the Pacific Rim countries now.
This I visited while on sabbatical leave. The previous one, where under the auspices of National Academy of Sciences, I felt that I'm developing a feel for the chemistry in the Third World. Russia and the other East European countries were definitely in that category. And what type of education was can one see at that time in the far Eastern Asian, East Asian countries.
What countries now did you go to?
From Burma, skipped India, went to Malaysia, went to Thailand, Singapore, Hong Kong, Indonesia, Japan, Australia, New Zealand.
Boy.
I think I didn't skip any. India, I felt we had too many students. We had enough experience, you know. The other one were really new to the research and teaching chemistry community. Japan was interesting to see what have they done after the war. I mean, they had a very good educational system modeled after the German educational system, and I was wondering how in the defeat how they were changing, if they were changing the education model. Australia, I was concentrating on the less well-known university. We all heard about Sydney and the National University, but they are smaller colleges, just like in America. New Zealand was fascinating, not from the educational point of view, but the beauty of New Zealand contributed to a very successful and enjoyable state. Kay and I met in Sydney Airport. We were just newlyweds for a second time. Kay and I were divorced for 2 years.
I didn't know that.
But I married my bridge partner, and that didn't last very long. But Kay said, "You'll come back." Indeed, I came back very glad and happy. But anyway, we were remarried in 1970. I was already scheduled for my trip far east, and said, "We will arrange it so that you can join me for at least a part of the time." And we were to meet at Sydney Airport. She coming along from Australia.